Say it ain't so, Joe. Here comes the Colonel.
Sarah Palin? Is she still around? How did Sarah Palin get in here? Well, welcome back to the second half hour, The Promise of Tomorrow, here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, and Sarah Palin. All right. Okay, an exciting second half we have for you. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And in just a minute, we're going to get back to Jack Bishop and his very exciting guest this half hour. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set. Rummage around in the coin jar just a bit and ask today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Aha, we have awakened the spirit of the fountain because throwing in the coins, the spirit of the fountain who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. All right, O spirit of the fountain, put on your thinking cap, or in this case, maybe your water cap. What did JFK refer to in noting, quote, "This is a new ocean, and I believe the United States should sail it," unquote? A new ocean. And the United States should sail it. What was John F. Kennedy referring to?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell the other.
Oh, yeah, the spirit of the fountain gets an easy one once in a while. JFK was referring to when he said, "This is a new ocean, and I believe the United States should sail it." If you said Antarctica, you are absolutely wrong. You ninny, it's space, of course, space. He was talking about the space race. All right, all right, all right. Back to Jack Bishop and today's program.
All this news about climate change and what's ahead for us has got everybody concerned. We decided that we would talk to somebody who is an expert in the field, somebody who is out there working with the problems that we're having and are going to have. You know, in our part of the world, we're in one of the worst droughts we've ever had in the southwestern part of the United States. But in other parts of the world, there's other things going on that are as equally or perhaps even more alarming and threatening. Ben Marcion is assistant professor geophysics at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. Thank you so much for being with us. Climate change
it's
is
my pleasure.
Climate change is affecting everyone around the world in different ways. One of the big concerns that everyone has is a change in the sea level, which one day may be world-shattering proportions because, I guess as the sea level changes, things start flooding, and the next thing you know, great, huge hunks of land are gone. Ben, let me ask you this question. Are we not already seeing some of this the sea level rise going on around the world?
Yes, we are definitely seeing some of the sea level rise already going on. So if you just look into the past 100 years, sea level has actually already been rising by about 20 centimeters. So that's just short of 10 inches. And so some of the flood events we are seeing, so if you're thinking, for example, of the effects that Hurricane Sandy had on the East Coast about 1.5 years ago, are definitely already influenced by the raised sea levels. So a storm of the magnitude of Sandy is quite rare. But if you imagine sea level going up slowly, you don't need a storm that strong anymore to create the same damage. And so when we are rising the sea levels, those damages are going to occur more frequently.
So it's kind of like the old science experiment of putting the frog in the water and then raising the temperature gradually. That's what's sort of been happening with our sea level. It's gradually been going up.
Yeah, that's actually it's a very good picture. Also because sea level is responding so slowly that so far we are seeing only a very small amount of what we are eventually going to get. So even if we were able to stop global warming right now, which probably is really, really hard to do, but if we were able to do that, sea level would still be going up for several hundreds of years. And there's really nothing we can do about it because the sea level is already responding to the changes to the atmosphere that we have caused in the past.
Now, paint a picture for me, if you would. As the sea level... paint a picture for me, if you would. As the sea level goes up, what are the coastal lines around the world going to be like? You know, what will we keep, what will we lose as far as important pieces of property?
It really depends on the time scale you're looking at. So first of all, the areas that are going to be impacted are, of course, the really low-lying coastal areas. And you can imagine that there are relatively big parts of Florida that are really low-lying, but also if you look on the European side, the Netherlands are actually already below sea level to some extent, and so they already depend on a permanent protection from dikes. If you look into Asia, Bangladesh has great areas of land that are lying really low, and also many people living there that will be impacted by sea level rise. And then if you wait long enough, you can actually see quite some impacts also in places where you wouldn't necessarily expect them. Because even if we are talking of just, and just is maybe not the best word, but just maybe 50 or 80 centimeters, so let's say 20 or 30 or 40 inches of sea level rise over the next 100 years, if we look further ahead than that, we are going to see sea level rise of the order of almost 10 meters. Which would be around 30 feet. And then you can see that actually many big cities and coastal cities are lying on ground that is lower than that. And so it will be really hard to protect these places. And so that includes, of course, places like New York in the U.S. And many cities in Europe and Asia as well.
You know, there have been a number of science fiction books and novels about this kind of rise. Two come to mind. One was the 1990s motion picture Waterworld. The other was a book that said that probably in 200 years or so, the continents would just be much smaller islands around the world. Is that the picture we may be looking at?
Within 200 years, not really. So sea level rise is going slowly but steadily. So we are really going to see changes in the shape of the continents within a time scale of about 2,000 years. And that may seem to be very far away and not of great concern, but for me, the really somewhat scary fact is that the decisions we are taking today matter on these long timescales. And so there will be many future generations that will actually have to live with the impacts of the decisions we are taking today. And for me, that's the important message.
Now, we know that global warming is what's causing all of this, but the effect that global warming is having is a melting of the polar ice caps. In Antarctica, and the Arctic. Now, with that in mind, there's not very much we can really do about this, is there? We're past the tipping point. Am I right?
Well, there are actually some things we can do, because, as I said, the sea level is responding slowly, and so some of the sea level rise in the future is inevitable. But how much we are really going to see depends strongly on how warm the world actually is going to get. And we have a strong way of influencing how warm the world is going to get, because we can actually decide how much CO2, that's the most important greenhouse gas, so how much CO2 we are going to emit into the atmosphere. And so it's really more or less our decision whether we want to see those strong impacts, or maybe don't want to see them but don't really care about them, or whether we say, okay, we need to adhere to some limits in the amount of CO2 we are emitting into the atmosphere so that we don't see the worst of those impacts.
Now, you mentioned Holland and the lowlands of Europe, and one of the questions that came to mind to me when we saw the flooding in New Orleans in this country a few years ago, The United States seems to be behind, at least to me, in how it deals with this kind of impact. And what are the things that we in this country could learn from you Europeans about sea level rise? And also this, let me throw this out first perhaps. Why do we see such a difference in regions? What's causing that when we're talking about coastal cities in various parts of the world?
Yeah. So if I maybe first start with your question about the regional differences, that's actually a point that is surprising many people, that sea level rise is going to be very different in different parts of the world. The reason for that, the most important reason, I would say there are several ones, but the most important reason is that the melting of the ice caps, the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica changes the gravity fields of the Earth. So if you imagine standing at the coast of Greenland, you have the big ice sheet in your back, and that big ice sheet is quite heavy, and that creates gravitational pull. So because you have the ice sheet in your back, the sea level is actually pulled towards you. Now when you start melting that ice sheet behind you, you take away mass from that ice sheet, which means the gravitational pull is actually getting weaker, which then means that the sea level close to the coast of Greenland is actually dropping, and instead the water is going elsewhere in the world. And the same is happening in Antarctica. And so essentially you get the worst sea level rise around the tropics, and you don't see very much sea level rise around the North Atlantic because of Greenland and in the Southern Oceans because of Antarctica.
Very complex kind of thing there.
Yeah, but that's also what for me makes the fun of the science, I could say.
Mm-hmm.
There are sometimes quite surprising results that you get from those complex interactions.
Well, in that case, let me ask you this then. We'll take a little side track here.
Yeah, of course.
What, in your studies, what has been the thing that surprised you the most that you've come across with sea level rise?
Yeah, it's actually really the magnitude of the sea level rise. And that comes from kind of looking behind the year 2100, which is a somewhat arbitrary limit, right? It's a nice number, 2100, and I can see where it comes from. It's because it's a time where people still can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So my grandchildren, for example, probably will see the year 2100, and so it's something that I can clearly relate to. But at the same time, it's a really arbitrary time frame because sea level rise is going to continue after that. And then I'm still surprised, actually, when I see the numbers of sea level rise we are going to get if we look into the longer time scales in the future, because several meters of sea level rise is just beyond what I can imagine, you know, standing on the coast somewhere and then imagining that the sea level is permanently 5 or 6 or 7 or maybe even 10 meters higher, and how that is going to change the coastline and the places where people are living. So cities will actually have to move. It's something that you don't really expect when you're considering most of the time just what is going to happen in the next 70 or 80 or 90 years.
You know, that is an interesting way to look at it. As you said, standing at the coastline, say today, and projecting into the future and realizing that that coastline may, as you say, be 70 meters higher. Now, as we go forth, as I said earlier, here in the United States, we're not hearing, at least in the mass media, very much about this. And I don't see where we're learning anything from our European brothers about how to handle sudden changes in our sea levels along our coasts. What can we do and what can we learn from Europe?
You know, I'm actually not really sure it's true that the U.S. is sort of behind on developing and applying the technologies that are necessary for mitigating climate change. To me, it really rather seems like two different approaches. Because, for example, I mean, there are some recent developments in the U.S. So, for example, if you look at the big solar power plant that was was becoming operational recently in the California desert, projects of that scale are actually really rare in Europe, and I think they are very efficient in reducing CO2 emissions effectively. And so it seems to me like the approach in the U.S. Seems to be rather market-driven. So the idea that you invest something now and then you get return in the future. And that's, that works on those large-scale power plants, but it also works, for example, when you consider insulating your house, right? Mm-hmm. You have to pay for the insulation now, but it means you're going to have reduced energy bills in the future, and so it turns out to be actually quite a good investment. And in Europe, the approach seems to be rather on actually restricting CO2 emissions and then letting the industry and consumers deal with how they are actually following those restrictions. And so I'm not a political scientist. I'm not really sure which way is more efficient, right? So you can either kind of prescribe you are not allowed to emit more CO2, or you can kind of trust the markets and say, you know, consuming energy actually means you have to pay for the energy. And so if we consume less energy, we are going to see the benefits of that also regarding climate change. I guess time will tell which approach is the better one.
Time always is the thing that is the arbitrator of all affairs and all events. China, Beijing, just recently decided that they would limit the amount of vehicular traffic in the capital city using some kind of system that I'm not sure if I remember. They just did the same thing in Paris, I understand. Is this one of the simple steps? This is one of the simple steps you could take, right, to mitigate that CO2 and carbon buildup, right?
Yeah, that's right. At least, you know, if you have other possibilities, reducing personal traffic, so driving less in the car, essentially, is quite effective because a large fraction of the greenhouse gas emissions is coming from traffic. And of course, it always depends then on whether you have alternatives. And there is maybe one point where I might agree that it seems to me that in European cities there are more alternative forms of transport, so light rail, public buses, and so on, that are also quite popular to use. And so in some sense it might be easier in some European cities to make the transition from private car transportation to public transport than in the U.S. But I guess also it's something that can be changed rather easily because, you know, introducing bus lines is not something that takes a great amount of planning and also isn't very costly, I would guess.
It never ceases to amaze me as somebody who grew up in a city in this country that had great mass transit starting back in the 1940s, even right up to today. As I got older and moved around the country and worked in other cities, and I wound up here in the Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area, it took 40 years, and that's just about how long I've been here, it took 40 years to get a light rail system in place for just one of these two cities. And they're just now talking about some sort of interconnection between the two. Now, for me, light rail or public transit in general was a given when I was a boy growing up in San Francisco. And for me, it has always been a good alternative because, you know, after a while, I started hating driving. Now, technology and how we're tackling this global problem of weather change seems to be the way to go. But we've got folks in this country who are climate change deniers. How about in Europe? Do you have a lot of them running around and saying, oh, it's nothing's happening, it's just the way the weather is? or are the folks in Europe a little more focused on this?
I think folks in Europe are a little more focused on this, but that doesn't mean that we don't have climate deniers. So I think it's a slightly different scale. I have to admit that I'm not entirely sure about the situation in the U.S. simply because my living experience, of course, is centered in Europe. But it is my impression that climate deniers are not at the center of the discussion in Europe, and to some extent, my impression is that in the U.S. They really shape a significant part of the discussion. And so that's clearly a difference. There seems to be in Europe generally a quite strong consensus, not only among scientists, so then among scientists in the U.S. there's also a strong consensus on climate change, but in Europe it also seems to be the case in the public.
We're winding down, Ben. If there was one thing that you would like for our audience to be aware of or to remember as we close out, what would it be?
I think it would be that it's really our individual decisions that are shaping our future, also when it's about climate change. It's an individual decision how much you're going to use your car and whether you're trying to use public transport if available. It's also your personal decision when you own a property, whether you're fixing it up with insulation, and which turns out to be a nice investment, as I said before, and at the same time it's reducing CO2 emissions quite a bit. So those are all kind of small steps that everybody of us can take individually to mitigate climate change and to make sure that the worst impacts are not going to happen, actually.
Now, Ben, I've got one final question. You mentioned you're a grandson. I spent some time yesterday with my granddaughter. How much should we worry about climate change and sea level increase and our grandchildren? Should I start looking at that mountain home in the Rockies?
You know, it's a hard question because for me, you know, my daily business is looking at how the climate is going to change in the future, and thinking about my children and grandchildren really is one of my strong personal incentives to try to make that not happen, right? So I think it's, of course, it's a very public issue, climate change, because it depends on our joint decisions, but it's also something that affects us very personally. And for me, clearly, worrying about children and grandchildren is something that is driving me, really.
Ben, thank you so much for being with us today. Been spending some time talking
thank
to Ben.
You.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Been spending some time talking to Ben Marchardson from the University of Innsbruck in Austria, talking about climate change and sea level rise around the world. This is the Science News Radio Network.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to the this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
One thing my father instilled in me, which is hold true today, is he said, your word is everything, and you live and breathe on your integrity, and never lose sight of your integrity. So as I look to that and say, how can I apply that moral or that value to what I do? And I look at every single person I meet, and not only am I proud and enthused about what, you know, say all the guardsmen, 9,000 of them that we have in our state, in our Commonwealth, but as I look in each and every one, I know that there's good in every one of them, and that they have value to our organization and our society. And so I use that integrity that my father instilled in me to say, how can I help them become better at doing their job and doing their service to our country and our Commonwealth? And that's what I take away. Major General Scott Rice, and I'm the Adjutant General for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
We live tomorrow, 'cause you know it will be there. I am waiting for you.